From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Living Off the Grid. Here's what's happening. We begin tonight's program on a very somber, sad note. Our dear friend, Coast to Coast regular guest, and one of the greatest guys I've ever known, UFO researcher Stanton Friedman, has died. Stanton is a former nuclear physicist, lecturer, world-renowned devotee of the extraterrestrial existence, and he died at the age of 84. The famed UFO researcher died Monday at Toronto's Pearson International Airport, according to his daughter. He was on his way home to Canada from a speaking engagement in Ohio. That speaking engagement was his last presentation. It was our stage show. He looked fine. He was in great spirits, did a great job on stage. And we said our goodbyes after the show, and then he headed back to his hotel, and then a day later, onto the airport. What's so ironic about all of this, with the loss of Stanton Friedman, when I was 21 years old, a reporter in Detroit, Michigan, he was my first radio interview, my first. How ironic that he would be interviewed by me as his last interview when he passed away. Stanton Friedman, dead at the age of 84. He will be missed. And another sad story, because one of the great comedians of all times, Tim Conway Sr., the actor and comedian best known for his work on The Carol Burnett Show and McHale's Navy, has died in Los Angeles. He was 85 years old. He had been battling a long-time illness prior to his death. I've got to tell you, back in 1961, 62, when McHale Navy hit the television screen, my dad used to watch this program all the time, and I'd hear him laughing and laughing, and I'd say, "Dad, what are you laughing at?" And he'd point, and it would be Tim Conway as one of the officers on McHale's Navy. I'll never forget those times. Tim Conway, dead at the age of 85. He was interviewed some time ago about his comedic life.
I never wanted to be in show business. I wanted to be a jockey. I was galloping horses at a couple of tracks in Cleveland, and I weighed about 95 pounds when I was a senior. And one day I was in the starting gate, and horses go from a dead stop to 40 miles an hour right now, as you know. And I'd never been in the starting gate before. My dad said, "Take the horse in the gate," and everything. The gates opened, and I looked down the track, and the horse was going down the track, and I said to myself, "I should actually be on that horse." And I think from there, I gave up the jockey business, and I went to Bowling Green State University for 11 years. Very hard to get through there. Then I went to the Army in 56. I defended Seattle for 2 years. As you know, they were not attacked. Most people go in for 2 years. You go in as a private, come out as a corporal, almost automatic. I went in as a private, came out as a private, and spent a little extra time because the military had no sense of humor.
Tim Conway Sr., dead at the age of 85, he was the father of a dear friend of ours, Tim Conway Jr., who is one of the hosts at KFI, our affiliate in Los Angeles. And Tim, our condolences to you and your family on the loss of your father. Investigators believe that Iran or groups that it supports used explosives to damage four ships off the United Arab Emirates on Sunday. What's going on there? At a major oil pipeline in Saudi Arabia was struck by armed drones and temporarily shut down, the kingdom's energy minister said, calling the move an act of terrorism and sabotage that marks the second attack on the Saudi oil infrastructure in as many days. And as you know, Iran is threatening us. Let's check in with Jerome Corsi, author of Atomic Iran. Jerry, I have a funny feeling about this, and it's not a good one. What do you think?
Well, it's a very dangerous situation right now, George, and I think that Iran is reacting to the increased sanctions the United States is putting on Iran after we pulled out of the agreement that John Kerry had negotiated in the Obama administration. And Iran is suffering economically. This pressure on Iran is going to build. I don't think the European allies are going to come to their aid the way Iran anticipates. and the attacks in Saudi Arabia, along with the United States ramping up military force in the Gulf area, strikes me as we're at the edge of the potential war. And I've always been, very, very cautious and tried to convince people that a war with Iran may not be the best solution to the problem.
I mean, Iran is tough. I mean, they got a tough Revolutionary Guard. I think in a head-to-head combat, eventually we would win, and then a lot of the citizenry of Iran is pro-Western. But I don't know. It just has a bad feeling, Jerry.
It does for me too, George, and I've been watching it very carefully. This regime, the Iranian regime, has been very, very tough on the people. I mean, I think the people in Iran would like to see the regime replaced with a less rigid, ideologically religious regime. But how you get rid of the Iranian regime has been a problem that's not been solved since 1979. And again, I think a military action would be a very difficult, very long, very complicated. Another war in the Middle East, I don't think, is going to be in our interest.
I think it's
ramping up.
Would it pull in Russia and China?
Well, I think it's one of the reasons that Secretary of State Pompeo is right now in Russia, really discussing with Russia how the situation is going to evolve. I mean, you've also got the Yemen, the Houthi, which are also backed by Iran to the south of Saudi Arabia, which were the ones initially blamed for the attacks on the pipeline and the attacks on the ships. If there's more attacks on Saudi Arabia, I think the violence is going to ramp up. And, George, we've got to watch it very carefully over the next few days, because we really are on the edge of a new war in the Middle East, which I think would be not in anyone's best interest at this point.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Corsi, Dr. Jerome Corsi. Newark, New Jersey's Liberty Airport has officially been dubbed the worst U.S. airport, according to a survey. They looked at 132 airports around the world, and in at least this country, the New Jersey-based hub was the lowest in the U.S. spot. The best airport, they say, is the Hamad International Airport in Qatar, followed by Tokyo International and Athens International. Top three good airports. I've never been to either one of them. After a couple days of selling across the board that left equities oversold and plunging, the Dow Jones Industrial jumped up a couple hundred points. But what does this all mean? Let's check in with registered investment advisor Mish Shedlock. Mish, what do you think? What's going on here?
George, very scary stuff today. Trump came out in a tweet that really took me back, and I was surprised there was not more talk in the mainstream media about it. But he came on today, and in his tweet, he accused China of pumping money and cutting interest rates. Okay, they are. But he said if the Fed ever did the same thing, it would be games over, lights out, match, as he said. He's itching for the Fed to get into a currency war with China, in addition to the trade war that he's already in. George, I disagree with both of these things. We do need an independent Fed. Actually, I would abolish the Fed if it was up to me. But if we're going to have one, it certainly needs to be independent of politicians. This is very scary stuff. I thought we would have had a trade deal now. Trump accused China of reneging on it. Did they renege? Probably. But did this administration put words into China's mouth that it could never accept in the first place? Probably. George, this is very scary stuff. I think an all-out currency war, again, I already think we're heading in for a recession. This is just very bad news on top of it.
On top of everything else. Thanks, Mish. Appreciate it. Being angry or being sad aren't particularly ideal dispositions for sound mental health. But which is worse when it comes to physical health? A new study finds that anger appears to be much more harmful, with the potential to increase one's risk for ailments like heart disease, arthritis, and even cancer in old age. Just remember that. Up next, Annie Jacobson back with us on Coast to Coast with her latest work, Surprise, Kill, Vanish, The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators, and Assassins. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We've got a great program for you in store tonight. Annie Jacobson back with us, investigative journalist and author who writes about war, weapons, U.S. national security, and government secrecy. Annie graduated from St. Paul's School and Princeton University. She was a contributing editor for the then Los Angeles Times magazine from 2009 until it closed in 2013. Her latest work is Surprise, Kill, Vanish, The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators and Assassins. You got a home run here, Annie. Great job.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you get this story?
Oh, my God. First of all, it's just great to be here, George. Do you realize that I think I've done I've been on the show with you for, I think, every book I've written.
Yes, so you sure have. And more to come. So you just keep doing it.
Thank you. This book is a big doozy. I mean, when I say that, I mean it's like chock full of things that are explosive and also raise real serious moral questions, right?
Yeah.
Back in 2009, I was actually writing my Area 51 book, and I was mostly dealing with spies and pilots and engineers. And a source that I knew, that I thought was a federal agent, was going to the Middle East. He stopped by my house, and he had with him a number of weapons cases. And he asked me if he could, I had young boys at the time, my boys were young, and he said, the boys were very interested in this, and they said, could they look at one of the guns? And the source was a licensed weapons instructor, so I said, that'd be fine. He was on his way to the Middle East. I knew that. I didn't know anything else. So he shows the boys this long sniper rifle. And I live up in the hills in Hollywood. And looking through the scope, I could see the veins on the leaf. That's how intense the scope was. And the boys were, you know, amazing. He gave the whole spiel, do this, do that, safety, safety, safety. There was one case he never opened, George. And when my boys went back to playing outside with their G.I. Joes, I said, what's in that case? He opened it up, and there was a very big knife with a serrated edge. And I said, what's that for? And he said, sometimes a job requires quiet.
Jeez.
And I went, okay. And I thought about that, George, all night. And I thought, what, you know, it really was unsettling to me. And then it became unsettling to me that I was unsettled by it, because I thought to myself, and this is a moral question, right? Or like a, like, why did it, why, I could see my source who I knew for almost 10 years at that point.
And trusted.
Yes. And I could see him. Okay. He's going to the Middle East. Now I know what he's doing. He's going over there, Taliban, Al Qaeda. And I could imagine him using that sniper rifle, but I couldn't imagine him slitting someone's throat or sticking it in their ribs to kill them. And it made me think, why do I have such a different reaction between those two forms of killing? They're both killing.
They're both killing. They're both heinous and sometimes, unfortunately, necessary if there are people out there to try to destroy us.
Well, exactly. And it really gave me pause, and it took me 10 years to report that story and figure out, you know, what I learned later, not from him, but from a colleague. He worked for the CIA's paramilitary division. And he worked on the ground in its most lethal element, which is called ground branch. Okay? Now, the drone strikes, that's air branch. CIA also has a wing called maritime branch that does, you know, operations in the water.
There was a drone strike just yesterday against some Saudi pipelines in Saudi Arabia, and Iran is blaming us, saying it's a false flag.
Which really escalates this idea of information, disinformation, paramilitary operations, operations outside the realm of normal warfare. I mean, this is all super interesting stuff to me, I think, to readers. It's why I wrote Surprise, Kill, Vanish.
And who do you believe, Annie? Because, you know, on one hand, you want to believe your government, of course, that they wouldn't even consider doing anything heinous like this, you know, doing false flags and stuff. Yet we have history, Gulf of Tonkin, for example, that got us into the Vietnam War. That didn't happen the way they said it did.
And the enemy, let's call them, right, Iran, that is one of our enemies, they know that. They are literate in history. So the question would be, are they using that against us, are their claims, in fact, a continuation of history? Or are they aware of our history and flipping it, you know? And we don't know. But what we do know is that Iran has drones. And I remember, I think we talked about this before, back in 2011, we sent what we called the Beast of Kandahar. That was the new Lockheed drone to spy on Iran. And Iran shot it down. Do you remember that?
That's right. It was a pretty good-sized drone, too.
Yes, and they had it on display. And it was like, well, there goes that whole Lockheed contract. Because once Iran has our drone, of course, they can reverse engineer it. So, you know, if I'm going to take this one step even further, I'm surprised, a la the Gary Powers incident, that someone didn't produce, and maybe they will, photographs of the drone. And what if it is an American drone? And then you can say, whichever side you're on, oh, well, that's Iran reverse engineering our drone.
I know that governments need to do things that the Americans and the Russian citizens and Chinese citizens aren't aware of for survival purposes. Though these things are necessary, sometimes unfortunate, but I think they have to happen. And, you know, when we were looking at your work on the secret history of the CIA and the paramilitary armies, on one hand, you go, oh, my God, how could they have this? But then on the other hand, Annie, you kind of say it's necessary. Where do you stand on that?
That is a great question. That is what I think that's what makes reading history, certainly me writing, reporting, and researching history, and I hope readers reading history, engaged. Because this is a question that does not end, okay? But I think it was said best, actually, by a reviewer of my book, where he said, because you brought up the word necessary evil, right?
Yep.
Or evil. And the reviewer actually said that. They said, this is a book about, because they were talking about how I interview firsthand sources. That is my forte. I get in with the men who do these operations. I traveled with them, my main character, Billy Wall. You know, we go places. We spend time together. I interview them at length trying to get that. And what the reviewer said was, this is a book about necessary evil. But what Annie does is she shows that the men who do these deeds are not necessarily evil.
And they definitely didn't start out that way.
You know, it's a big puzzle because, you know, the guys that work for the CIA paramilitary operations, what I find super interesting about a lot of this is that most of them are older, okay? Like the average operator that I interviewed, and I interviewed 42 of them, they were in their 50s.
That's old for an operator. For a covert operator.
They're talking about operations from, let's say, 5-6 years ago, okay? But that 45, now Billy Wall, who's my main character, he was in Libya going after Gaddafi at age 82. I mean, his cover was that he was an old man. Okay?
Jeez.
He was in Afghanistan the day, you know, a week after 9/11, age 72.
That's amazing.
So the CIA goes for all kinds of people who have all kinds of experience. And that is interesting because these are top tier one performers. Maybe they were Deltas before, SEALs, Green Berets. They go over to the CIA to join the paramilitary army after they retire from their work in special operations.
How many members do you think are in this paramilitary unit?
It's hard. Numbers they are very secretive about, but after 9/11, the CIA went and led the war in Afghanistan. That's really known by a very few, but not known by a lot.
Are they working in tandem with our military, or are they on their own?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. So, okay. So, right after 9/11, the CIA sent. This is one of the very few numbers I actually got from a source on the record. The CIA sent 115 of its guys. That's not a lot.
No, that's not. Stay with us, Annie. We'll talk more about it and really get into your work. Surprise, kill, vanish. Annie Jacobson with us, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Now, Friday night, last hour, a special tribute to Stanton Friedman, who just passed away. Shockingly, we were just with Stanton in Columbus, Ohio, last Saturday, and he was funny and laughing and having a great time, but he passed away of an apparent heart attack at the Toronto International Airport, and he will be severely missed, to be sure. But the last hour Friday of the program, we're going to do a special tribute with some guests who have known him, your calls, and some audio of Stanton Friedman. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Annie Jacobson, with her latest work, Surprise, Kill, Vanish. And Annie, as we get into this, where can people get your book?
You know, bookstores everywhere, and good old Amazon, Barnes & Noble online, independent booksellers, everywhere they sell books.
Super. Now, we were talking before the break about how many members might be involved in these paramilitary units. Are they involved with the military? Are they working on their own? What kind of cooperation is there between the military branches and the CIA?
A great question. So where we left off was 115 special operators from the CIA went into Afghanistan. They were augmented by 2,000 special forces operators from the Pentagon. So those were SEALs, Delta, Green Berets. So that gives you an idea of, like, how they mix. Now, the paramilitary operations are also sometimes run by what's called a singleton, meaning one guy. And that was mostly the case with my main character, a guy named Billy Waugh. He's now 89. As I was telling you, he was in Afghanistan when he was 72. He was going after Gaddafi when he was 82.
Jeez.
In Libya. He did most of his missions alone. He took the first surveillance photographs of Osama bin Laden in 1992.
Wow. Did he get Gaddafi? Was he one of those responsible for the uprising?
He wasn't. He went after, he was actually looking for, according to him, he was looking for Gaddafi's generals who he had worked with in the 70s for the CIA. That was his first mission after Vietnam. And I write this whole story out in Surprise, Kill, Vanish. And it's just astonishing to realize how it works, and also how a guy like Billy Waugh has worked across six decades for the agency, and how loyal they are to a guy like him. And here's why, because he never screwed up.
What was he to do had he found those generals? Kill them?
That's where it gets a little vague, George. You know, I ask those questions, and it's, you know, I can't talk about that. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, I can't talk about that in the book. And then when I get to the end, I don't want to ruin my ending, but I'm going to tease it here, right?
Yeah.
He talks about a team. He says to me, I can't talk about that, but I did get others to talk about a top secret actual assassination unit called the Stalker Team, which was authorized by George Bush right after 9/11. And they went after guys in NATO partner countries.
That's interesting. Now, I wonder, did you ever talk to him about the JFK assassination? I'm just curious.
I did not, but I talked to the Secret Service about the JFK assassination, and that was interesting. And I write about that a little bit in the book, because one of the characters I profile as well as Billy Waugh was another Green Beret in Vietnam, because, of course, they all start out, or most of them start out as, you know, military guys. And Lou Merletti is the kind of parallel story to Billy Waugh. He ended up becoming the 19th director of the Secret Service. And it was a real privilege for me to get him to talk to me, because no Secret Service director has gone on the record before. And he was very coy about not sharing, you know, classified tactics of what the Secret Service does to keep our president from being assassinated. But he gave me this incredible narrative sense of a super secret element of the Secret Service, which most people don't know about, which he was on, which is called CAT, Counter Assault Team. And that is a secret unit of paramilitary operators that shadows the President of the United States and has ever since Reagan was almost killed by an assassin. And they follow the president everywhere, and they're not their job, unlike the Secret Service agents who are designed to, like, put their body in front of the president and protect him. The CAT team members are basically there, ready on a moment's notice to go full out paramilitary assault on any attack that would come at the president.
Andy,
they're like fire first.
The name of your book is called Surprise, Kill, Vanish. Tell me about those three words at the top. Mm-hmm.
It comes from the actual motto of the CIA, the organization that existed before the CIA was called the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. And that was the unit in World War II that was assigned to kill Nazis. How were they going to kill them? With a knife, if need be. And that's where that serrated knife I talked to you about before came from. A lot of CIA guys get their own personalized knife. And it comes from the fact that the OSS Jedburghs that went after Nazis in World War II, jumped out of airplanes and did whatever they had to do to take down these Nazis, their motto was surprise, kill, vanish.
Interesting. Well, it's great work. Now, the CIA, with these rogue operations, do you think then, and you mentioned assassin squads, just how prevalent are they? Do they go into all these countries? I mean, are they in Iran right now? What are they doing?
That is a really, really interesting thing to think about. Because, for example, Billy Waugh, who we spoke about, he was on what was called the Iran desk. Okay, so he was part of the unit that was in charge of Iran. And yet, I write about operations that he did in, you know, Libya, Sudan, Saudi Arabia, Southeast Asia. You know, he operated in 62 countries around the world, but guess what one country that he never spoke of operating in? Iran.
Interesting.
But he was on the Iran desk. So you have to ask, well, does that mean you can't tell me about your operations in Iran? Or does that mean the CIA, it's so dangerous for a CIA person in Iran that they don't go there? I don't know. That's a mystery.
And what about past presidents? You mentioned George Bush, and we're talking about Junior?
We're talking about George Bush, War on Terror Bush. But here's the interesting thing. I mean, all of the presidents, the earlier presidents for sure had, assassination programs up until the Church Committee hearings after Vietnam that were so famous, where allegedly assassination was outlawed, which it wasn't, which I write about in the book. But, you know, they called it they had euphemisms. For example, Eisenhower called his the Health Alteration Committee. Okay? And these are declassified documents from the National Archives that I looked at and that I report on. JFK called his assassination program executive action. Reagan called his preemptive neutralization. Bush, we talked about, his was called lethal direct action. And Obama's, because remember, this is not just a conservative president decision. Obama actually had the biggest assassination program to date, from what I was able to learn and report. And his was called targeted killing, because that is what drone strikes really amounts to. It is the same concept as what these operators do on the ground. It just happens to happen in the air.
Were you in shock when you were talking to Billy Waugh?
Give me shock how? Like
with some of the things he was saying.
The most shocking situation that I learned about from Billy Waugh had to do actually in Vietnam. And that was, I mean, I know it seems like ancient history, but boy, did this, and I write the whole story out in the book, but they were assigned to kill General Giap. And do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
Go back in the archives in the mind there, General Giap, the fearsome leader of the North Vietnamese army. I mean, he was more powerful than Ho Chi Minh in many ways. And he was the top man that the Defense Department and CIA wanted killed. So Waugh was in the lead man on this mission. And I write about the whole mission. It was called Oscar 8 because Jop was coming to a secret location on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos. And we helicoptered in all these guys, and it was an absolute fiasco. And the NVA shot down all the helicopters bringing the CIA guys in. Hua was in the air. He was higher up than the helicopters. He was in charge of what was called forward air control, so he was looking at the whole mission from a small Cessna, and he saw the whole thing happen. The guys get shot down, so it immediately changes from a kill General Jop mission to a rescue our guys mission. And one after the next, aircraft get shot down trying to get those guys out. And it's just astonishing. It's unbelievable.
I just wonder how many places they're in, Andy. I mean, are they in North Korea? Are they, you know, still in Iraq? I guess they're still in Afghanistan. Where are they?
I know that the CIA's paramilitaries are in 84 countries, at least.
That's 84?
84, right, that they're actively working in. But, you know, my guess is, it's astonishing how big their reach is and yet how small their footprint is, right? Because you asked that question.
That's right.
Very important, how big are they? This is not, even though I say paramilitary armies, we're talking about, you know, a unit of 12 guys.
Trained killers.
They are trained to not just kill, but they are trained to infiltrate, you know, to get into the target in a manner, if it means jumping out of a aircraft in what's called a halo, high altitude, low opening. So they jump out of the aircraft, they free fall, terminal velocity, down really low so that no radar picks up their parachute. Pull the ripcord at like 1,000 feet.
Jeez, and pray to God they land safely, huh?
Right. Then they land, and then they do what they have to do, and then they exfiltrate, in another manner that is stealthy, all for the goal of plausible deniability.
Now here's the plus and the minus of, let's say, for example, George Bush's authorization of his assassin team, which I think Dick Cheney may have been behind, quite frankly. But on one hand, you want to get these terrorists and kill them and be done with these people. On the other hand, they haven't been convicted yet of anything. And I'm not talking about the 9/11 terrorists, but those in these other countries that they sent these assassins to do whatever they were going to do to them. So they're literally murdering or killing citizens of other countries who haven't committed the crime yet.
Which takes us to that moral conundrum I spoke of in the very beginning, right? Well, think about this, what you just said, George, because you said they haven't yet done. So,
I mean, is it okay if you break in on them and you see a guy making a bomb, hasn't detonated it yet, hasn't planted it yet, but he's making it?
That's the question. And where do you draw the line?
Where do you draw that line?
That's right. And now what I will tell you, because I interviewed the CIA lawyer, John Rizzo, who wrote many of these presidential findings. That's what they're called. Because every one of these operations, by the way, is signed off on by the president. These are not rogue. We may think of them as rogue, but this is not the CIA saying, okay, let's go do this, don't tell the president. The president must sign off on them. And the way I know that, or I believe that I know that to be true, is that the times that they were not happening was when Clinton was in office, because he was the only president to speak of, besides Carter, who would not sign off on any of these operations, any of the direct lethal action operations. So your question about neutral, you know, is preemptive. That's what Reagan called it. He called it preemptive neutralization. And when Bush, right after 9/11, signed off on this, what's called a memorandum of notification, to allow these teams to go out and preemptively kill people that were deterred, you know, the government decided needed to die.
Well, that's a key phrase. The government decided.
Yes.
So what happens here at home, Annie, if some groups of people decide to do the same thing and they take the power to decide on their own who goes and who doesn't?
Well, I mean, you mean if a rogue, if a citizenry did that?
Yeah. What if they say, you know, let's start taking out, we had all these homicides in Chicago. Let's start taking out people right now without convicting them, without courts. They just have a rogue group that goes out, almost like vigilantes, that go out and just do what they have to do because they think it's the right thing to do.
Yes, and then they would be subject to being tried for murder. So here's another interesting conundrum on that. Even the military can't do this, by the way, right? In the same way that you just gave that scenario. If the military cannot kill people outside of a war theater that we're fighting in, which is why here's a misnomer, right? Most people think, oh, who killed bin Laden in Pakistan?
Right.
The Navy SEALs. Not accurate. That was a CIA mission. They were Navy SEALs, but in a very quick ceremony, they were quickly made CIA operators for that mission. None of their uniforms had any military markings on them whatsoever, because if the mission had gone south, it would have been plausibly denied. And they were working for the CIA. That was a Title 50 CIA paramilitary operation, period. They're not really known or acknowledged by anyone. But that's why you see Leon Panetta in the room, that famous photograph where they're all looking at the TV camera.
Yeah.
There's Panetta front and center because he was the director of the CIA. He was in charge of it.
Well, I got to tell you, on one hand, I am not opposed to this because there are truly some places and individuals and groups that want to see us down and wiped out, and we need to fight back. On the other hand, I hope we get the right people. That's what concerns me.
And this is why I find the whole subject so fascinating. And I think you, by bringing your own curiosity, and that's a thin word, so that's not right to really say when you're talking about killing people, but by bringing your own, like, desire to know more about your country, let's say, it's significant because it makes you involved in the question of these big issues and not take them so for granted as that's wrong, that's right.
Exactly.
They're much more nuanced than that.
Andy, we're going to take a break. We'll come back and take phone calls and continue chatting with you about your book, Surprise, Kill, Vanish.